The following podcast is brought to you by The Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
First of all, what a beautiful evening it is here in New York. And it's exciting because I had to close the shade because the sun was coming in too strong. And the last time that I gave a talk, it was dark out at this time. So it's a cool thing. And in my reflecting and going over this and preparing for this talk, I thought about what has shifted for me the most in my years of practice at the Village Zendo. And the answer that came to me is the focus has switched in a major way for me from being in my head or in my mind to the focus being on physical body. When something presents itself physically in the body, we have an actual place where we can enter, as opposed to this kind of spacing place that we can get to in our head. I think that very often in our lives, physical things pop up, but that we have many divisive ways to turn away from what we might be experiencing internally. And sometimes that can develop into a kind of numb place or not quite sure what we're feeling sometimes. And often we can miss the actual experience that we're having in those moments. So, of course, sitting Zazen is a tool to increase our awareness of our internal experience. But I have found the practice of liturgy to be very helpful in this area. Now, when I say liturgy, just to be clear, I'm speaking of the physical forms that we use in Zen practice. Bowing, chanting, walking, turning, lighting incense, offering incense, how you hold your hands in gassho. There seems to be a very specific form for every little thing that we do as soon as we enter the temple or the zendo. And I understand that many people have adverse reactions to liturgy, especially if you have grown up in a very austere religious environment. But I'll try to explain how I found this practice helpful over the years and how it has helped shift my practice. So when we sit Zazen, I think it's very easy. We can very easily space out, right? I think all of us have had an experience after a period of Zazen that we just had a 30-minute long daydream. And sometimes it's just too enticing. Our mind, when we're sitting, it's just too enticing and just pulls us off. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But that is something that cannot happen when we're in a service, when we're in liturgy. Because if you start to space out, you will quickly get left behind, right? If you space out while you're chanting a Japanese verse and you have the book up and then you space out, you're never going to catch up again. Like, you're looking the whole time. Or maybe you're spaced out and you're standing up and all of a sudden you look down and you realize everyone's bowing. Or you forget to take a book when the ushers come, right? There's all kinds of things. When we're in a service, a liturgy service, things are happening very quickly. The form of our services really requires that we are fully present in body and mind. For some reason, especially when we are holding a service position, where we have to strike a bell or carry incense or move in some manner, liturgy practice can bring up a lot of stuff for us. And it's amazing to me that we have all experienced suffering on all kinds of levels right, from past traumas and illnesses and the loss of a loved one, painful relationships, all kinds of obstacles and trials and tribulations that we've all navigated and dealt with. Yet, during a service, we may forget to strike a bell in a certain place. And when the realization of that hits us, it's like our whole world crumbles. And we're, you know, utterly crushed. We have this intense internal experience over the simplest of things. And I think anyone who has ever held a service position on retreat probably understands what I'm speaking about. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of a background, my background in liturgy at the Zendo. Liturgy was always something that kind of came a little simple to me because I'm a musician, so I've always been dealing with organizing sound with movement. It's something that I've done all my life, so it was pretty quick for me to figure out, okay, there's three bells here, there's two bells there. Kind of came to me quite quick. And so eventually was put in a position where I was going to be trained to know all the positions. You know, I went through each position and then I started to get trained to become a liturgy minister. And the training that I received was quite strict. And I liken it to this, when I was writing a talk, I liken it to this story of a swordsman teacher, and just a short version of it. The student went there and basically became the teacher's servant and was, you know, would clean up after him and do all the chores. And for a long time, he didn't teach him anything. And then all of a sudden, one day while he was hanging the laundry, the teacher came up from behind him with a big wooden sword and smack, whacked him right in the butt. So then he turned around and he didn't know what hit him. And this kept happening over and over and over again until he was completely on guard all the time. Well, that's a little bit like the experience that I had. Every time a service would end, I was looking around. I knew that that wooden sword was coming to smack me somewhere. If I'd made a mistake or if I forgot to see something, you know, it was kind of ingrained in me, all the forms of the way that they quote unquote should be and what is right and what is wrong, the correct way to do it, the incorrect way to do it. And anyway, so this all led up to the very first time that I was going to be the liturgy master on a retreat at the Zendo. And it was at the Grail. It was one of our residential retreats. And the first segment, because it was these retreats would get split up into 4 weeks. The first week went really smooth. It was filled with longtime practitioners and people that knew all the roles pretty well. And you know, it was maybe a tiny bit little shaky at first, but then we very quickly became a well-oiled machine, and everything was going great. And so then that first week ended, and then the second week began, which was the precepts week. And in these middle weeks, we typically would get people who were a lot of times newer to the practice and were trying to dip their toes in and check out maybe a study week before a formal Zen session. So needless to say, the liturgy team that was assembled for this second week was hardly the caliber of the first week. And when that first morning service happens, you know, after we barely get a rehearsal the evening before, the first service happened, and it was an absolute train wreck. Everything that could possibly go wrong went wrong. The soge entered the room before turning around to bow and ring the bell. The jiko forgot to pick up the box. You know, everything that could possibly go wrong went wrong. And it was like, you know, people would turn around and be like, no, we have to go back. You know, it was absolutely horrifying. And at the end of that service, I was just completely crushed. I just felt like an absolute failure. And I thought for sure that I was going to get, at the very least, an earful once this was over. And so, you know, during the residential retreats after service, we immediately would go back into the Zendo to have Oryoki, to have a meal. And so, you know, we're standing in the Buddha hall, and I'm just dreading walking out of that room. And so we finally march out, and I walk out of the room, and I look up at Roshi, and she's standing there with the biggest smile on her face. Just like a big smile on her face. And something in that moment, it just clicked for me and completely shifted. And I realized that there was something about the spirit of liturgy that I was really missing. And it's that it wasn't about doing things right or wrong or being incorrect or correct, but it's really about being together and what is happening in this very moment right now. So what was happening in that moment? My perceived failure had me burning. My chest was on fire. I had this this really intense knot in my stomach. My heart rate was elevated, right? Bam! Right there in front of me was this wide open entry point. And I had never really realized that before. So I started to wonder and question during these moments, during those moments that are very, very poignant in liturgy, I find, can we take a step back? And like Eckhart Tolle says, can we take a step back and observe ourselves thinking? Can we observe our own mind? That feeling in the chest or that feeling in the belly, can I turn to it? I don't have to touch it or feel like I have to dive in or solve it, but I also can stop myself from turning away from it, right? And I could just kind of allow myself to be with it and maybe play with it. And just see where it, and just see where it kind of brings me inside. For this, you know, for me, this meant seeing the forms of service not as correct or incorrect, right or wrong, but as I said, being with ourselves in community and being with ourselves with our internal experience. So can we be compassionate to our internal experience at the same time that we are compassionate to everyone else, to others all around us in our external experience? Can we do that at the same time? And I think liturgy presents a really wonderful arena to experiment with this. And, you know, whether you feel confident about your form or your knowledge of the forms and what is the right way and the correct way to do it, or if you're the opposite, if you just like beat yourself up and you always think that you're making a mistake, and when you make a mistake, you feel like good for nothing. All of these responses, every single one of them, is always accompanied by some kind of a physical manifestation, a physical feeling in our body. Those feelings are such fertile areas for us to just step into and to really see what is happening. Really see what is happening in our lives. And I think that that practice, in many ways, is a little bit closer to what we actually do in our lives on a daily basis and the action of day to day, right? We could sit on a cushion all day, like I said, and space out. But when we're active and when we're with community moving, we have to be in the moment. And those things are going to pop up, especially when it's around community and around others. Things are going to pop up all the time. And if we can start to notice the physical feelings as they pop up and kind of catch them in a sense, like don't let them slip away. Kind of notice that, like, oh, there was that feeling here. And there's something of that you can remember about that. And it's a place that you can go. Also in your Zazen, you know, so then after this kind of pops up in liturgy, you can go there in your Zazen. Or you can go there in your everyday life. It teaches us to bring the mind of Zazen into our movement and into our relationship with others. So in doing some research and reading about liturgy, I came upon this passage by Peter Kruzan Ashireson, who is a teacher at the Zen Center of Fresno. I don't know who he is, but I was looking up to see what some different contemporary teachers were saying about Zen forms. And this is this passage that he writes. He says, "I've spent time in Japan as a Zen student and as a tourist, and it seems clear to me that we Americans are never going to, quote, get it right. If getting it right means matching the way the Japanese embodies and forms. We haven't grown up hearing and seeing the embodiment of these forms, so they're never going to be integrated in our bodies the same way. And why should they? To the extent that we try to act Japanese, we also miss assimilating, modifying, and integrating these forms in the ways that are deeply compatible with our own culture. An American friend who lived in Japan for decades explained the key difference he sees between Japanese and American cultures. In Japanese culture, form has a higher priority than content. And in American culture, it's the reverse. It's not that Japanese don't care about content or that Americans don't care about form. It's just a question of priority. So in Japan, there's one way to do any given thing. You don't make it up as you go along. You wait for the light to change before you cross the street, even if there's no traffic. You take your assigned seat, even if the train car is empty. In America, we improvise, try a new way, challenge and test how it's to be done. There's no right way to do anything. There's no one right way to do anything. The most important implication is that we need to find ways to feel and be as natural as we can, to be ourselves when we're practicing. I'm not suggesting we move quickly or radically away from the traditions we've inherited, but we should also remember that at some point, each form was made up by someone. A bow in and of itself is no more holy than a handshake or a salute. So after we've learned and understood and practiced the traditional forms, we should allow ourselves to experiment with change when and where it fits our distinctive American culture and circumstances." And this is something I've thought about for a while, because if we look at the history of Zen Buddhism, right? I saw it written by D.T. Suzuki, where he basically said that, you know, we all look at Bodhidharma coming from the West and coming to China as we see him as kind of the great granddaddy of Zen. But D.T. Suzuki was asserting that it wasn't until the sixth patriarch, Huaining, who was six generations after that, that Zen was codified. And his reasoning for that was that the essential teachings and everything that Bodhidharma brought over was deeply profound and inherited by the Chinese culture. But the aesthetic of the way that it was presented and the way that it was taught didn't quite fit. It was a more temperate climate. And so they took the imagery of the countless bodhisattvas, coming together in one room, and the millions upon billions of kalpas, and all this majestic imagery. They boiled it down to a shit stick, right, or a bag of flax, right? They had to make it. They had to bring it down to earth to make sense for them culturally. And I think that we are in the midst of that right now in America and in the West, right? This Japanese, it's so from China, it went to Japan and it adopted a Japanese aesthetic. And now that's come over here. And there's, of course, there's certain areas of the aesthetic that I think that we are drawn to, right? And just like Dizzy Gillespie famously said, that it's important to always have one foot in the past and one foot in the present, moving towards the future. I think it's important for us to always hold and know where our Zen forms came from. But I think we're also in this place of where we're trying to figure it out for ourselves as in a different culture and to see how this works for us. So I think that's something else to take into consideration when we're thinking about the right way and the wrong way and the correct way to do things. It's kind of morphing. It's moving around and it's something new is coming from this. And I think it's kind of exciting because I feel that we're in it. We're really in this process right now. So as we slowly start to emerge from the pandemic and things start to slowly return to normal, I want to encourage everyone to maybe once we get back to normal, maybe come out to a Friday liturgy class or come to a Zazen Kai or come to a retreat. And you know, kind of allow your whole body to enter the services and to enter the forms and to, instead of seeing things as right and wrong and doing things the right way, the correct way, just kind of follow along and see what comes up for you. See what comes up for you in your body as you move your body. I wanted to end with a small passage about Master Obaku, who was the teacher of Rinzai. And as you might imagine, being the teacher of Rinzai, he was famous for being frequently very strict to his students. And he would frequently say, "Don't expect anything from the three treasures." Time after time, he was heard to say this. One day, however, Master Obaku was observed in the act of bowing, and he was challenged about his practice. A monk approached him and said, "You always tell your students not to expect anything from the three treasures, and yet you have been making deep bows." In fact, he had been bowing so frequently and for so long that a large callus had formed on his forehead at the point where it touched the floor. When he was asked how he explained this, Obaku replied, "I don't expect, I just bow."